He shouldn't want to be with him. As he handed it to him, he could see that Willem was amused, slightly, but then he started to read it, and his expression changed, and he retreated to his study so he wouldn't have to watch him. After a while, Willem knocked. "Can I come in?" he asked, and he told him he could. "I'm looking at point number 2, said Willem, seriously. "I hate to tell you this, Jude, but we have the same body." He looked at him. "You're an inch taller, but can I remind you that we wear each other's clothes?" He sighed. "Willem," he said, "you know what I mean." "Jude," Willem said, "I understand that this is strange for you and unexpected. If you really don't want this, I'll back off and leave you alone, and I promise things won't change between us." He stopped. "But if you're trying to convince me not to be with you because you're scared and self-conscious, well, I understand that. But I don't think it's a good enough reason not to try. We'll go as slowly as you want, I promise." He was quiet. "Can I think about it?" he asked, and Willem nodded. "Of course," he said, and left him alone, sliding the door shut behind him. He sat in his office in silence for a long time, thinking. After Caleb, he had sworn he would never again do this to himself. He knew Willem would never do anything bad to him, and yet his imagination was limited. He was incapable of conceiving of a relationship that wouldn't end with his being hit, with his being kicked down the stairs, with his being made to do things he had told himself he would never have to do again. Wasn't it possible, he asked himself, that he could push even someone as good as Willem to that inevitability? Wasn't it foregone that he would inspire a kind of hatred from even Willem? Was he so greedy for companionship that he would ignore the lessons that history, his own history, had taught him? But then there was another voice inside him, arguing back. "You're crazy if you turn this opportunity down," said the voice. "This is the one person you have always trusted. Willem isn't Caleb. He would never do that. Not ever." And so, finally, he had gone to the kitchen where Willem was making dinner. "Okay," he said. "Let's do it." Willem had looked at him and smiled. "Come here," he said, and he did, and Willem kissed him. He had been scared and panicky, and once again he had thought of Brother Luke, and he had opened his eyes to remind himself that this was Willem, after all, not someone to fear. But just as he was relaxing into it, he had seen Caleb's face flashing through his mind like a pulse, and he pulled away from Willem, choking, rubbing his hand across his mouth. "I'm sorry," he said, pivoting away from him. "I'm sorry. I'm not very good at this, Willem." "What do you mean?" Willem had asked, turning him back around. "You're great at it." And he had felt himself sag with relief that Willem wasn't angry with him. Since then, he has been constantly pitting what he knows of Willem against what he expects of someone, anyone, who has any physical desire for him. It is as if he somehow expects that the Willem he has known will be replaced by another, as if there will be a different Willem for what is a different relationship. In the first few weeks, he was terrified that he might upset or disappoint Willem in some way, that he might drive him toward anger. He had waited for days, summoning his courage, to tell Willem that he couldn't tolerate the taste of coffee in his mouth, although he didn't explain to him why. Brother Luke, his awful, muscular tongue, the grain of coffee grinds that had permanently furred his gum line. This had been one of the things he had appreciated about Caleb, that he hadn't drunk coffee. He apologized and apologized until Willem told him to stop. "Jude, it's fine," he said. "I should have realized. Really. I just won't drink it." "But you love coffee," he said. Willem had smiled. "I enjoy it, yes," he said, "but I don't need it." He smiled again. "My dentist will be thrilled." Also in that first month, he had talked to Willem about sex. They had these conversations at night, in bed, when it was easier to say things. He had always associated night with cutting, but now it was becoming about something else. Those talks with Willem in a darkened room, when he was less self-conscious about touching him, and where he could see every one of Willem's features, and yet was also able to pretend that Willem couldn't see his. "Do you want to have sex someday?" he asked him one night, and even as he was saying it, he heard how stupid it sounded. But Willem didn't laugh at him. "Yes," he said, "I'd like to." He nodded. Willem waited. "It's going to take me a while," he said at last. "That's okay," Willem said. "I'll wait." "But what if it takes me months?" "Then it'll take months," Willem said. He thought about that. "What if it takes longer?" he asked quietly. Willem had reached over and touched the side of his face. "Then it will," he said. They were quiet for a long time. "What are you going to do in the meantime?" he asked, and Willem laughed. "I do have some self-control, Jude," he said, smiling at him. "I know this comes as a shock to you, but I can go for stretches without having sex." "I didn't mean anything," he began, remorseful, but Willem grabbed him and kissed him noisily on the cheek. "I'm kidding," he said. "It's okay, Jude. You'll take as long as you need." And so they still haven't had sex, and sometimes he is even able to convince himself that maybe they never will. But in the meantime, he has grown to enjoy, to crave even, Willem's physicality, his affection, which is so easy and natural and spontaneous that it makes him feel easier and more spontaneous as well. Willem sleeps on the left side of the bed, and he on the right, and the first night they slept in the same bed, he turned to his right on his side, the way he always did, and Willem pressed up against him, tucking his right arm under his neck and then across his shoulders, and his left arm around his stomach, moving his legs between his legs. He was surprised by this, but once he overcame his initial discomfort, he found he liked it, that it was like being swaddled. One night in June, however, Willem didn't do it, and he worried he had done something wrong. The next morning, early mornings were the other time they talked about things that seemed too tender, too difficult to be said in the daylight, he asked Willem if he was upset with him, and Willem, looking surprised, said no, of course not. "I just wondered," he began, stammering, "because last night you didn't..." But he couldn't finish the sentence. He was too embarrassed. But then he could see Willem's expression clear, and he rolled into him and wrapped his arms around him. "This?" he asked, and he nodded. "It was just because it was so hot last night," Willem said, and he waited for Willem to laugh at him, but he didn't. "That's the only reason, Judy." Since then, Willem has held him in the same way every night, even through July, when not even the air conditioning could erase the heaviness from the air, and when they both woke damp with sweat. This, he realizes, is what he wanted from a relationship all along. This is what he meant when he hoped he might someday be touched. Sometimes Caleb had hugged him, briefly, and he always had to resist the impulse to ask him to do it again, and for longer. But now, here it is. All the physical contact that he knows exists between healthy people who love each other and are having sex, without the dreaded sex itself. He cannot bring himself to initiate contact with Willem, nor ask for it, but he waits for it, for every time that Willem grabs his arm as he passes him in the living room and pulls him close to kiss him, or comes up behind him as he stands at the stove and puts his arm around him in the same position, chest, stomach, that he does in bed. He has always admired how physical J.B. and Willem are, both with each other and with everyone around them. He knew they knew not to do it with him, and as grateful as he was for their carefulness with him, it sometimes made him wistful. He sometimes wished they would disobey him, that they would lay claim to him with the same friendly confidence they did with everyone else. But they never did. It took him 3 months, until the end of August, to to finally take off his clothes in front of Willem. Every night he came to bed in his long-sleeved t-shirt and sweatpants, and every night Willem came to bed in his underwear.
"Is this uncomfortable for you?"
Willem asked, and he shook his head, even though it was uncomfortable, but not entirely unwelcome. Every day the month before, he promised himself he would take off his clothes and be done with it. He would do it that night, because he had to do it at some point. But that was as far as his imagination would let him proceed. He couldn't think about what Willem's reaction might be, or what he might do the following day. And then night would come, and they would be in bed, and his resolve would fail him. One night, Willem reached beneath his shirt and put his hands on his back, and he yanked himself away so forcefully that he fell off the bed.
"I'm sorry," he told Willem. "I'm sorry."
And he climbed back in, keeping himself just at the edge of the mattress. They were quiet, the two of them. He lay on his back and stared at the chandelier. "You know, Jude," Willem said at last, "I have seen you without your shirt on." He looked at Willem, who took a breath. "At the hospital," he said. "They were changing your dressings and giving you a bath." His eyes turned hot, and he looked back up at the ceiling.
"How much did you see?" he asked.
"I didn't see everything," Willem reassured him. "But I know you have scars on your back, and I've seen your arms before." Willem waited, and then when he didn't say anything, sighed.
"Jude, I promise you it's not what you think it is. I'm afraid you're going to be disgusted by me,"
he was finally able to say. Caleb's words floated back to him. "You really are deformed. You really are." "I don't suppose I could just never take my clothes off at all, right?" he asked, trying to laugh, to turn it into a joke.
"Well, no," Willem said, "because I think, although it's not going to feel like it initially, it'll be a good thing for you, Judy."
And so the next night, he did it. As soon as Willem came to bed, he undressed quickly, under the covers, and then he flung the blanket away and rolled onto his side so his back was facing Willem. He kept his eyes shut the entire time, but when he felt Willem place his palm on his back, just between his shoulder blades, he began to cry, savagely, the kind of bitter, angry weeping he hadn't done in years, tucking into himself with shame. He kept remembering the night with Caleb, the last time he had been so exposed, the last time he had cried this hard, and he knew that Willem would only understand part of the reason he was so upset, that he didn't know the shame of this very moment, of being naked, of being at another's mercy, was almost as great as his shame for what he had revealed. He heard, more from the tone than from the words themselves, that Willem was being kind to him, that he was dismayed and was trying to make him feel better. But he was so distraught that he couldn't even comprehend what Willem was saying. He tried to get out of the bed so he could go to the bathroom and cut himself, but Willem caught him and held him so tightly that he couldn't move, and eventually he somehow calmed himself. When he woke the following morning, late, it was a Sunday, Willem was staring at him. He looked tired.
"How are you?"
he asked. The night returned to him.
"Willem," he said, "I'm so, so sorry. I'm so sorry. I don't know what happened."
He realized then that he still wasn't wearing any clothes, and he put his arms beneath the sheet and pulled the blanket up to his chin.
"No, Jude," Willem said. "I'm sorry. I didn't know it was going to be so traumatic for you."
He reached over and stroked his hair. They were quiet.
"That was the first time I've ever seen you cry, you know."
"Well," he said, swallowing,
"for some reason it's not as successful a seduction method as I'd hoped,"
and smiled at Willem, a little, and Willem smiled back. They lay in bed that morning and talked. Willem asked him about certain scars, and he told him. He explained how he had gotten the scars on his back.
about the day he had been caught trying to run away from the home, the beating that had followed, the resulting infection, the way his back had wept pus for days, the bubbles of blisters that had formed around the stray splinters from the broom handle that had embedded themselves into his flesh, what he had been left with when it was all over. Willem asked him when he was last naked before anyone, and he lied and told him that, except for Andy, it had been when he was 15. And then Willem said various kind and unbelievable things about his body, which he chose to ignore, because he knew they weren't true. "Willem, if you want out, I understand," he said. It had been his idea not to tell anyone that their friendship might be changing into something else, and although he had told Willem it would give them space and privacy to figure out how to be with each other, he had also thought it would give Willem time to reconsider, opportunities to change his mind without fear of everyone else's opinions. Of course, with this decision, he cannot help but hear the echoes of his last relationship, which had also been conducted in secrecy, and he had to remind himself that this one was different. It was different unless he made it the same. "Jude, of course I don't," Willem said. "Of course not." Willem was running his fingertip over his eyebrow, which for some reason he found a comforting gesture. It was affectionate, without being in the least sexual. "I just feel like I'm going to be this series of nasty surprises for you," he said at last, and Willem shook his head. "Surprises, maybe," he said, "but not nasty ones." And so every night he tries to remove his clothes. Sometimes he can do it, other times he can't. Sometimes he can allow Willem to touch him on his back and arms, and other times he can't. But he has been unable to be naked before Willem in the daytime, or even in light, or to do any of the things that he knows from movies and eavesdropping on other people that couples are supposed to do around each other. He cannot get dressed in front of Willem, or shower with him, which he'd had to do with Brother Luke, and which he had hated. His own self-consciousness has not, however, proven contagious, and he is fascinated by how often and how matter-of-factly Willem is naked. In the morning he pulls back Willem's side of the blanket and studies Willem's sleeping form with a clinical rigor, noting how perfect it is, and then remembers, with a strange, queasy giddiness, that he is the one seeing it, that it is being bestowed upon him. Sometimes the improbability of what has happened wallops him, and he is stilled. His first relationship, can it be called a relationship? Brother Luke. His second, Caleb Porter. And his third, Willem Ragnarsson, his dearest friend, the best person he knows, a person who could have virtually anyone he wanted, man or woman. And yet for some bizarre set of reasons, a warped curiosity, madness, pity, idiocy, has settled on him. He has a dream one night of Willem and Harold sitting together at a table, their heads bent over a piece of paper, Harold adding up figures on a calculator, and he knows, without being told, that Harold is paying Willem to be with him. In the dream, he feels humiliation, along with a kind of gratitude, that Harold should be so generous, that Willem should play along. When he wakes, he is about to say something to Willem when logic reasserts itself, and he has to remind himself that Willem certainly doesn't need the money, that he has plenty of his own, that however perplexing and unknowable Willem's reasons are for being with him, for choosing him, that he has not been coerced, that he has made the decision freely. That night he reads in bed as he waits for Willem to come home, but falls asleep anyway and wakes to Willem's hand on the side of his face. "You're home," he says, and smiles at him, and Willem smiles back. They lie awake in the dark, talking about Willem's dinner with the director and the shoot, which begins in late January in Texas. The film, Duets, is based on a novel he likes, and follows a closeted lesbian and a closeted gay man, both music teachers at a small-town high school,
through a 25-year marriage that spans the 1960s through the 1980s. I'm going to need your help, Willem tells him. I really, really have to brush up on my piano playing. And I am going to be singing in it, after all. They're getting me a coach, but will you practice with me? Of course, he says. And you don't need to worry. You have a beautiful voice, Willem. It's thin. It's sweet. Willem laughs and squeezes his hand. Tell Kit that, he says. He's already freaking out. He sighs. How was your day? He asks. Fine, he says. They begin to kiss, which he still has to do with his eyes open, to remind himself that it is Willem he is kissing, not Brother Luke, and he is doing well until he remembers the first night he had come back to the apartment with Caleb, and Caleb's pressing him against the wall, and everything that followed, and he pulls himself abruptly away from Willem, turning his face from him. I'm sorry, he says. I'm sorry. He has not taken off his clothes tonight, and now he pulls his sleeves down over his hands. Beside him, Willem waits, and into the silence, he hears himself saying, Someone I know died yesterday. Oh, Jude, says Willem. I'm so sorry. Who was it? He is silent for a long time, trying to speak the words. Someone I was in a relationship with, he says at last, and his tongue feels clumsy in his mouth. He can feel Willem's focus intensify, can feel him move an inch or two closer to him. I didn't know you were in a relationship, says Willem, quietly. He clears his throat. When? When you were shooting the Odyssey, he says, just as quietly, and again he feels the air change. Something happened while I was away, he remembers Willem saying. Something's wrong. He knows Willem is remembering the same conversation. Well, says Willem, after a long pause, tell me, who was the lucky person? He can barely breathe now, but he keeps going. It was a man, he begins, and although he's not looking at Willem, he's concentrating on the chandelier. He can feel him nod encouragingly, willing him to continue. But he can't. Willem will have to prompt him, and he does. Tell me about him, Willem says. How long did you go out for? 4 months, he says. And why did it end? He thinks of how to answer this. He didn't like me very much, he says at last. He can feel Willem's anger before he hears it. So he was a moron, Willem says, his voice tight. No, he says. He was a very smart guy. He opens his mouth to say something else. What, he doesn't know, but he can't continue. And he shuts it, and the two of them lie there in silence. Finally, Willem prompts him again. Then what happened? He asks. He waits, and Willem waits with him. He can hear them breathing in tandem, and it is as if they are bringing all the air from the room, from the apartment, from the world, into their lungs, and then releasing it, just the two of them, all by themselves. He counts their breaths, 5, 10, 15. At 20, he says, If I tell you, Willem, do you promise you won't get mad? And he feels Willem shift again. I promise, Willem says, his voice low. He takes a deep breath. Do you remember the car accident I was in? Yes, says Willem. He sounds uncertain, strangled. His breathing is quick. I do. It wasn't a car accident, he says, and as if on cue his hands begin to shake, and he plunges them beneath the covers. What do you mean? Willem asks, but he remains silent, and eventually he feels, rather than sees, Willem realize what he's saying. And then Willem is flopping onto his side, facing him, and reaching beneath the covers for his hands. Jude, Willem says, did someone do that to you? Did someone...
He can't say the words.
Did someone beat you?
He nods, barely, thankful that he's not crying, although he feels like he's going to explode. He imagines bits of flesh bursting like shrapnel from his skeleton, smacking themselves against the wall, dangling from the chandelier, bloodying the sheets.
Oh, God,
Willem says, and drops his hands, and he watches as Willem hurries out of bed.
Willem,
he calls after him, and then gets up and follows him into the bathroom, where Willem is bent over the sink, breathing hard. But when he tries to touch his shoulder, Willem shrugs his hand off. He goes back to their room and waits on the edge of the bed, and when Willem comes out, he can tell he's been crying. For several long minutes, they sit next to each other, their arms touching, but not saying anything.
Was there an obituary?
Willem asks, finally, and he nods.
Show me,
Willem says. And they go to the computer in his study, and he stands back and watches Willem read it. He watches as Willem reads it twice, three times. And then Willem stands and holds him, very tightly, and he holds Willem back.
Why didn't you tell me?
Willem says into his ear.
It wouldn't have made a difference,
he says. And Willem steps back and looks at him, holding him by the shoulders. He can see Willem trying to control himself, and he watches as he holds his long mouth firm, his jaw muscles moving against themselves.
I want you to tell me everything,
Willem says. He takes his hand and walks him to the sofa in his study and sits him down.
I'm going to make myself a drink in the kitchen, and then I'm coming back,
Willem says. He looks at him.
I'll make you one, too.
He can do nothing but nod. As he waits, he thinks of Caleb. He never heard from Caleb after that night, but every few months he would look him up. There he was, for anyone to see. Pictures of Caleb smiling at parties, at openings, at shows. An article about Rothko's first freestanding boutique, with Caleb talking about the challenges a young label encounters when trying to break out in a crowded market. A magazine piece about the reemergence of the Flower District, with a quote from Caleb about living in a neighborhood that, despite its hotels and boutiques, still felt appealingly rough-edged. Now, he thinks, did Caleb ever look him up as well? Did he show a picture of him to Nicholas? Did he say, I once went out with him? He was grotesque. Did he demonstrate to Nicholas, whom he imagines as blonde and neat and confident, how he had walked? Did they laugh with each other about how terrible, how lifeless he had been in bed? Did he say, he disgusted me? Or did he say nothing at all? Did Caleb forget him? Or at least choose never to consider him? Was he a mistake? A brief, sordid moment? An aberration to be wrapped in plastic and shoved to the far corner of Caleb's mind, with broken toys from childhood and long-ago embarrassments? He wishes he too could forget, that he too could choose never to consider Caleb again. Always, he wonders why and how he has let 4 months, months increasingly distant from him, so affect him, so alter his life. But then, he might as well ask, as he often does, why he has let the first 15 years of his life so dictate the past 28. He has been lucky beyond measure. He has an adulthood that people dream about. Why, then, does he insist on revisiting and replaying events that happened so long ago? Why can he not simply take pleasure in his present? Why must he so honor his past? Why does it become more vivid, not less, the further he moves from it? Willem returns with 2 glasses of ice and whiskey. He has put on a shirt. For a while they sit on the sofa, sipping at their drinks, and he feels his veins fill with warmth.
I'm going to tell you,
he says to Willem, and Willem nods. But before he does, he leans over and kisses Willem. It is the first time in his life that he has ever initiated a kiss, and he hopes that with it, He is conveying to Willem everything he cannot say. Not even in the dark, not even in the early morning gray. Everything he is ashamed of, everything he is grateful for. This time he keeps his eyes closed, imagining that soon he too will be able to go wherever people go when they kiss, when they have sex. That land he has never visited, that place he wants to see, that world he hopes is not forbidden to him forever. When Kit was in town, they met either for lunch or dinner or at the agency's New York offices, but when he came to the city in early December, Willem suggested they meet instead at Green Street. "I'll make you lunch," he told Kit. "Why?" asked Kit, instantly wary. Although the two of them were close in their own way, they weren't friends, and Willem had never invited him over to Green Street before. "I need to talk to you about something," he said, and he could hear Kit making his breaths long and slow. "Okay," said Kit. He knew better than to ask what that something might be, and whether something was wrong. He just assumed it. "I need to talk to you about something" was not, in Kit's universe, a prelude to good news. He knew this, of course, and although he could have reassured Kit, the slightly diabolical part of him decided not to. "Okay," he said, brightly. "See you next week." On the other hand, he thought after he hung up, maybe his refusal to reassure Kit wasn't just childishness. He thought what he had to tell Kit, that he and Jude were now together, wasn't bad news, but he wasn't sure Kit would see it the same way. They had decided to tell just a few people about their relationship. First, they told Harold and Julia, which was the most rewarding and enjoyable reveal, although Jude had been very nervous for some reason. This had been just a couple of weeks ago at Thanksgiving, and they had both been so happy, so excited, and they had both hugged him, and Harold had cried a little, while Jude sat on the sofa and watched the three of them, a small smile on his face. Then they told Richard, who hadn't been as surprised as they'd anticipated. "I think this is a fantastic idea," he'd said, firmly, as if they'd announced they were investing in a piece of property together. He hugged them both. "Good job," he said. "Good job, Willem." And he knew what Richard was trying to communicate to him. The same thing he had tried to communicate to Richard when he told him, years ago, that Jude needed somewhere safe to live, when really, he was asking Richard to look over Jude when he could not. Then they told Malcolm and JB separately. First, Malcolm, who they thought would either be shocked or sanguine, and who had turned out to be the latter. "I'm so happy for you guys," he said, beaming at them both. "This is so great. I love the idea of you two together." He asked them how it had happened, and how long ago, and, teasingly, what they'd discovered about the other that they hadn't known before. The two of them had glanced at each other then, if only Malcolm knew, and had said nothing, which Malcolm had smiled at, as if it was evidence of a rich cache of sordid secrets that he would someday unearth. And then he'd sighed. "I'm just sad about one thing, though," he'd said, and they had asked him what it was. "Your apartment, Willem," he said. "It's so beautiful. It must be so lonely by itself." Somehow they had managed not to laugh, and he had reassured Malcolm that he was actually renting it to a friend of his, an actor from Spain who had been shooting a project in Manhattan and had decided to stay on for another year or so. JB was trickier, as they'd known he would be. They knew he would feel betrayed and neglected and possessive, and that all of these feelings would be exacerbated by the fact that he and Oliver had recently split up after more than 4 years. They took him out to dinner, where there was less of a chance, though, as Jude pointed out, no guarantee, that he would make a scene, and Jude, around whom JB was still slightly careful, and to whom JB was less likely to say something inappropriate, delivered the news. They watched as JB put his fork down and put his head in his hands. "I feel sick," he said, And they waited until he looked up and said, "But I'm really happy for you guys," before they exhaled. JB forked into his burrata. "I mean, I'm pissed that you didn't tell me earlier, but happy." The entrees came, and JB stabbed at his sea bass. "I mean, I'm actually really pissed, but I am happy." By the time dessert arrived, it was clear that JB, who was frantically spooning up his guava souffle, was highly agitated, and they kicked each other under the table, half on the verge of hysterics, half genuinely concerned that JB might erupt right there in the restaurant. After dinner, they stood outside, and Willem and JB had a smoke, and they discussed JB's upcoming show, his fifth, and his students at Yale, where JB had been teaching for the past few years. A momentary truce that was ruined by some girl coming up to him, "Can I get a picture with you?" at which JB made a sound that was somewhere between a snort and a groan. Later, back at Green Street, he and Jude did laugh. At JB's befuddlement, at his attempts at graciousness, which had clearly cost him, at his consistent and consistently applied self-absorption. "Poor JB," Jude said. "I thought his head was going to blow off." He sighed. "But I understand it. He's always been in love with you, Willem." "Not like that," he said. Jude looked at him. "Now who can't see themselves for who they are?" he asked, because that was what Willem was always telling him, that Jude's vision, his version of himself, was singular to the point of being delusional. He sighed, too. "I should call him," he said. "Leave him alone tonight," Jude said. "He'll call you when he's ready." And so he had. That Sunday, JB had come over to Green Street, and Jude had let him in and then had excused himself, saying he had work to do, and closed himself in his study so Willem and JB could be alone. For the next 2 hours, Willem had sat and listened as JB delivered a disorganized roundelay, whose many accusations and questions were punctuated by his refrain of, "But I really am happy for you." JB was angry that Willem hadn't told him earlier, that he hadn't even consulted him, that they had told Malcolm and Richard, before him. JB was upset. Willem could tell him the truth. He'd always liked Jude more, hadn't he? Why couldn't he just admit it? Also, had he always felt this way? Were his years of fucking women just some colossal lie that Willem had created to distract them? JB was jealous. He got the attraction to Jude, he did, and he knew it was illogical and maybe a tiny bit self-involved, but it wouldn't be truthful if he didn't tell Willem that part of him was miffed that Willem had picked Jude and not him. "JB," he said again and again, "it was very organic. I didn't tell you because I needed time to figure it out in my own head. And as for being attracted to you, what can I say? I'm not. And you aren't attracted to me, either. We made out once, remember? You said it was a huge turnoff for you, remember?" JB ignored all this, however. "I still don't understand why you told Malcolm and Richard first," he said sullenly, to which Willem had no response. "Anyway," JB said, after a silence, "I really am happy for you two. I am." He sighed. "Thank you, JB," he said. "That means a lot." They were both quiet again. "JB," said Jude, coming out of his study, looking surprised that JB was still there. "Do you want to stay for dinner?" "What are you having?" "Cod. And I'll roast some potatoes the way you like them." "I guess," JB said sulkily, and Willem grinned at Jude over JB's head. He joined Jude in the kitchen and began making a salad, and JB slumped to the dining room table and started flipping through a novel Jude had left there. "I read this," he called over to him. "Do you want to know what happens in the end?" "No, JB," said Jude. "I'm only halfway through. The minister character dies after all."
"JB!"
After that, JB's mood seemed to improve. Even his final salvos were somewhat listless,
as if he were delivering them out of obligation rather than true depth of feeling. In 10 years, I'll bet you two will have made the full transition to lesbiandom. I predict cats was one. And watching you two in the kitchen is like watching a slightly more racially ambiguous version of that John Curran painting. Do you know what I'm talking about? Look it up, was another. Are you going to come out or keep it quiet? J.B. asked over dinner. I'm not sending out a press release, if that's what you mean, Willem said. But I'm not going to hide it either. I think it's a mistake, Jude added, quickly. Willem didn't bother answering. They had been having this argument for a month. After dinner, he and J.B. lounged on the sofa and drank tea, and Jude loaded the dishwasher. By this time, J.B. seemed almost appeased, and he recalled that this was the arc of most dinners with J.B., even back at Lispenard Street. He began the evening as something sharp and tart, and ended it as something smoothed and gentled. How's the sex? J.B. asked him. Amazing, he said immediately. J.B. looked glum. Damn it, he said. But of course this was a lie. He had no idea if the sex was amazing because they hadn't had sex. The previous Friday, Andy had come over, and they'd told him, and Andy had stood and hugged them both very solemnly, as if he was Jude's father, and they had told him that they had just gotten engaged. Willem had walked him to the door, and as they were waiting for the elevator, Andy said to him, quietly, "How's it going?" He paused. "Okay," he said at last, and Andy, as if he could discern everything he wasn't saying, squeezed his shoulder. "I know it's not easy, Willem," he said, "but you must be doing something right. I've never seen him more relaxed or happier, not ever." He looked as if he wanted to say something else, but what could he say? He couldn't say, "Call me if you want to talk about him," or "Let me know if there's anything I can help you with," and so instead he left, giving Willem a little salute as the elevator sank out of sight. That night, after J.B. had gone home, he thought of the conversation he and Andy had had in the cafe that day, and how even as Andy had been warning him how difficult it would be, he hadn't fully believed him. In retrospect, he was glad he hadn't, because believing Andy might have intimidated him, because he might have been too scared to try. He turned and looked at Jude, who was asleep. This was one of the nights he'd taken off his clothes, and he was lying on his back, one of his arms crooked near his head, and Willem, as he often did, ran his fingers down the inside of this arm, its scars rendering it into a miserable terrain, a place of mountains and valleys singed by fire. Sometimes, when he was certain Jude was very deeply asleep, he would switch on the light near his side of the bed and study his body more closely, because Jude refused to let him be examined in daylight. He would uncover him and move his palms over his arms, his legs, his back, feeling the texture of the skin change from rough to glossy, marveling at all the permutations flesh could take, all the ways the body healed itself, even when attempts had been made to destroy it. He had once shot a film on the big island of Hawaii, and on their day off, he and the rest of the cast had trekked across the lava fields, watching the land change from rock as porous and dry as petrified bone into a gleaming black landscape, the lava frozen into exuberant swirls of frosting. Jude's skin was as diverse, as wondrous, and in places, so unlike skin as he had felt or understood it, that it too seemed something otherworldly and futuristic, a prototype of what flesh might look like 10,000 years from now. "You're repulsed," Jude had said, quietly, the second time he had taken his clothes off, and he had shaken his head. And he hadn't been. Jude had always been so secretive, so protective of his body, that to see it for real was somehow anticlimactic. It was so normal, finally, so less dramatic than what he had imagined. But the scars were difficult for him to see, not because they were aesthetically offensive, but because each one was evidence of something withstood or inflicted. Jude's arms were for that reason the part of his body that upset him the most. At nights, as Jude slept, he would turn them over in his hands, counting the cuts, trying to imagine himself in a state in which he would willingly inflict pain on himself, in which he would actively try to erode his own being. Sometimes there were new cuts. He always knew when Jude had cut himself, because he slept in his shirt on those nights, and he would have to push up his sleeves as he slept and feel for the bandages. And he would wonder when Jude had made them, and why he hadn't noticed. When he had moved in with Jude after the suicide attempt, Harold had told him where Jude hid his bag of razors, and he, like Harold, had begun throwing them away. But then they had disappeared entirely, and he couldn't figure out where Jude was keeping them. Other times, he would feel not curiosity, but awe. He was so much more damaged than Willem had comprehended. "How could I have not known this?" he would ask himself. "How could I not have seen this?" And then there was the matter of sex. He knew Andy had warned him about sex, but Jude's fear of and antipathy toward it disturbed and occasionally frightened him. One night toward the end of November, after they'd been together 6 months, he had reached his hands down Jude's underwear, and Jude had made a strange, strangled noise, the kind of noise an animal makes when it's being caught in another animal's jaws, and had jerked himself away with such violence that he had cracked his head against his nightstand. "I'm sorry," they had apologized to each other. "I'm sorry." And that was the first moment that Willem, too, had felt a certain fear. All along he had assumed that Jude was shy, profoundly so, but that eventually he would abandon some of his self-consciousness, that he would feel comfortable enough to have sex. But in that moment, he realized that what he had thought was a reluctance to have sex was actually a terror of it, that Jude would perhaps never be comfortable, that if and when they did eventually have sex, it would be because Jude had decided he had to, or Willem decided he had to force him. Neither option appealed to him. People had always given themselves to him. He had never had to wait, never had to try to convince someone that he wasn't dangerous, that he wasn't going to hurt them. "What am I going to do?" he asked himself. He wasn't smart enough to figure this out on his own, and yet there was no one else he could ask. And then there was the fact that, with every week, his desire grew sharper and less ignorable, his determination greater. It had been a long time since he had wanted to have sex with anyone so keenly, and the fact that it was someone he loved made the waiting both more unbearable and more absurd. As Jude slept that night, he watched him. "Maybe I made a mistake," he thought. Aloud, he said, "I didn't know it was going to be this complicated." Next to him, Jude breathed, ignorant of Willem's treachery. And then the morning arrived, and he was reminded why he had decided to pursue this relationship to begin with, his own naivete and arrogance aside. It was early, but he had woken anyway, and he watched as, through the half-open closet door, Jude got dressed. This had been a recent development, and Willem knew how difficult it was for him. He saw how hard Jude tried. He saw how everything he and everyone he knew took for granted, getting dressed in front of someone, getting undressed in front of someone, were things that Jude had to practice again and again. He saw how determined he was. He saw how brave he was being. And this reminded him that he, too, had to keep trying. Both of them were uncertain. Both of them were trying as much as they could. Both of them would doubt themselves, would progress and recede. But they would both keep trying, because they trusted the other. And because the other person was the only other person who would ever be worth such hardships, such difficulties, such insecurities and exposure. When he opened his eyes again, Jude was sitting on the edge of the bed and smiling at him, and he was filled with affection for him. For how beautiful he was, for how dear he was, for how easy it was to love him. "Don't go," he said. "I have to," Jude said. 5 minutes, he said. 5, Jude said. and slid beneath the covers, and Willem wrapped his arms around him, careful not to wrinkle his suit, and closed his eyes. And this, too, he loved. He loved knowing that in those moments he was making Jude happy, loved knowing that Jude wanted affection, and that he was the person who was allowed to provide it. Was this arrogance? Was this pride? Was this self-congratulation? He didn't think so. He didn't care. That night, he told Jude that he thought they should tell Harold and Julia that they were together when they went up for Thanksgiving that week. "Are you sure, Willem?" Jude had asked him, looking worried, and he knew that Jude was really asking if he was sure about the relationship itself. He was always holding the door open for him, letting him know he could leave. "I want you to really think about this, especially before we tell them." He didn't need to say it, but Willem knew, once again, what the consequences would be if they told Harold and Julia, and later he changed his mind. They would forgive him, but things would never be the same. They would always, always pick Jude over him. He knew this. It was the way it should be. "I'm positive," he'd said, and so they had. He thought of this conversation as he poured Kit a glass of water and carried the plate of sandwiches to the table. "What is this?" Kit asked, looking suspiciously at the sandwiches. "Grilled peasant bread with Vermont cheddar and figs," he said, "and escarole salad with pears and jamon." Kit sighed. "You know I'm trying not to eat bread, Willem," he said, although he didn't know. Kit bit into a sandwich. "Good," he said reluctantly. "Okay," he continued, putting it down. "Tell me." And so he did, and added that while he wasn't planning on announcing the relationship, he wasn't going to pretend otherwise about it either. And Kit groaned. "Fuck," he said. "Fuck. I thought it might be this. I don't know why, I just did. Fuck, Willem." He put his forehead down on the table. "I need a minute," Kit said to the table. "Have you told Emil?" "Yeah," he said. Emil was Willem's manager. Kit and Emil worked with each other best when they were united against Willem. When they agreed, they liked each other. When they didn't, they didn't. "And what did he say?" "He said, 'God, Willem, I'm so happy that you finally committed to someone you truly love and feel comfortable around, and I couldn't be happier for you as your friend and longtime supporter.'" What Emil had actually said was, "Christ, Willem, are you sure? Did you talk to Kit yet? What did he say?" Kit lifted his head and glared at him. He didn't have much of a sense of humor. "Willem, I am happy for you," he said. "I care about you. But have you thought about what's going to happen to your career? Have you thought about how you're going to be typecast? You don't know what it's like being a gay actor in this business." "I don't really think of myself as gay, though," he began, and Kit rolled his eyes. "Don't be so naive, Willem," he said. "Once you've touched a dick, you're gay." Said with subtlety and grace, as always. "Whatever, Willem. You can't afford to be cavalier about this." "I'm not, Kit," he said. "But I'm not a leading man."
"You keep saying that, but you are, whether you like it or not. You're just acting like your career is going to keep going on the same trajectory it's been on. Do you not remember what happened to Carl?"
Carl was a client of a colleague of Kit's, and one of the biggest movie stars of the previous decade. Then he had been forced out of the closet, and his career had faded. Ironically, it was Carl's obsolescence, his sudden unpopularity, that had encouraged the rise of Willem's own career. At least two roles that Willem had gotten were ones that would once have gone reflexively to Carl. "Now look, you're far more talented than Carl and more diversified as well. And it's a different climate now than when Carl came out, domestically at least. But I'd be doing you a disservice if I didn't tell you to prepare for a certain chill. You're private as it is. Can't you just keep this under wraps?"
He didn't reply, just reached for another sandwich, and Kit studied him.
"What does Jude think?"
"He thinks I'm going to end up performing in a Candor and Ebb review on a cruise ship to Alaska," he admitted. Kit snorted.
somewhere between how Jude thinks and how you think is how you need to think, Willem, he said. After everything we've built together, he added, mournfully. He sighed, too. The first time Jude had met Kit, almost 15 years ago, he'd turned to Willem afterward and said, smiling, he's your Andy. And over the years, he had come to realize how true this was. Not only did Kit and Andy actually creepily know each other, they were in the same class and had lived in the same dorm their freshman year, but they both liked to present themselves as, to some extent, Willem's and Jude's creators. They were their defenders and their guardians, but they also tried, at every opportunity, to determine the shape and form of their lives. I thought you'd be a little more supportive of this, Kit, he said, sadly. Why? Because I'm gay? Being a gay agent is far different than being a gay actor of your stature, Willem, said Kit. He grunted. Well, at least someone's going to be happy about this. Noel, the director of duets, will be fucking thrilled. This is going to be great publicity for his little project. I hope you like doing gay movies, Willem, because that's what you might end up doing for the rest of your life. I don't really think of duets as a gay movie, he said, and then, before Kit could roll his eyes and start lecturing him again, and if that's how it ends up, that's fine. He told Kit what he had told Jude. I'll always have work, don't worry. But what if your film work dries up? Jude had asked. Then I'll do plays, or I'll work in Europe. I've always wanted to do more work in Sweden. Jude, I promise you, I will always, always work. Jude had been silent then. They had been lying in bed. It had been late. Willem, I really won't mind, not at all, if you want to keep this quiet, he said. But I don't want to, he said. He didn't. He didn't have the energy for it, the sense of planning for it, the endurance for it. He knew a couple of other actors, older, much more commercial than he, who actually were gay and yet were married to women. And he saw how hollow, how fabricated their lives were. He didn't want that life for himself. He didn't want to step off the set and still feel he was in character. When he was home, he wanted to feel he was truly at home. I'm just afraid you're going to resent me, Jude admitted, his voice low. I'll never resent you, he promised him. Now he listened to Kit's gloomy predictions for another hour, and then finally, when it was clear that Willem wouldn't change his mind, Kit seemed to change his. Willem, it'll be fine, he said determinedly, as if Willem had been the one who was concerned all along. If anyone can do this, you can. We're going to make this work for you. It's going to be fine. Kit tilted his head, looking at him. Are you guys going to get married? Jesus, Kit, he said. You were just trying to break us up. No, I wasn't, Willem. I wasn't. I was just trying to get you to keep your mouth shut, that's all. He sighed again, but resignedly this time. I hope Jude appreciates the sacrifice you're making for him. It's not a sacrifice, he protested, and Kit cut his eyes at him. Not now, he said, but it may be. Jude came home early that night. How'd it go? He asked Willem, looking closely at him. Fine, he said staunchly. It went fine. Willem, Jude began, and he stopped him. Jude, he said, it's done. It's going to be fine, I swear to you. Kit's office managed to keep the story quiet for 2 weeks, and by the time the first article was published, he and Jude were on a plane to Hong Kong to see Charlie Ma, Jude's old roommate from Hereford Street, and from there to Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. He tried not to check his messages while he was on vacation, but Kit had gotten a call from a writer at New York Magazine, and so he knew there would be a story. He was in Hanoi when the piece was published. Kit forwarded it to him without comment, and he skimmed it quickly when Jude was in the bathroom. Ragnarsson is on vacation and was unavailable for comment, but his representative confirmed the actor's relationship with Jude St. Francis, a highly regarded and prominent litigator with the powerhouse firm of Rosen, Pritchard, and Klein, and a close friend since they were roommates their freshman year of college, he read. And Ragnarsson is the highest profile actor by far to ever willingly